Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss, and I've been closely tracking the ETF space for more than 13 years through a variety of roles here at SeekingAlpha.com. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investing goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of the individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. A brief scheduling note here before we get into today's episode. I'll be taking a break for Memorial Day next week, with the next episode coming out the first week in June, probably Tuesday of that week. I've got a great show planned about the long case for Vietnam and the VanEck Vectors Vietnam ETF VNM with Wing Capital Investments' Vincent Yip. With everything happening to supply chains as a result of COVID-19, you will not want to miss that episode. Wishing everyone health, sanity, and investing success as we experience a Memorial Day unlike any in recent memory. See you in less than 2 weeks. For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the morning of Tuesday, May 12th, 2020. I'm rejoined today by macro specialist Eric Basmajian. Eric is head of macro research at Perval Global, a discretionary hedge fund specializing in global macro-driven trades across all major asset classes. He first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2017, building up a large following of investors and becoming Seeking Alpha's top contributor in the economy vertical through his unparalleled analysis of key macroeconomic trends and his ability to turn this analysis into actionable top-down portfolio advice. In 2017, Eric launched his Seeking Alpha marketplace service, EPB Macro Research, and he hasn't looked back since. In addition to the steady stream of macro analysis subscribers to EPB Macro Research receive, they also gain access to EPB's model tactical asset allocation and long-only asset allocation portfolios, an active chat room, and direct access to Eric. And of course, relevant to listeners of this podcast, those portfolios are all ETF portfolios. You can subscribe to EPB Macro Research by going to SeekingAlpha.com and typing Eric Basmajian, that's Basmajian, into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to SeekingAlpha.com/marketplace and looking for EPB Macro Research there. All right, let's get into it. Welcome back to the podcast, Eric.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, it's great you were able to rejoin me so soon. I was always planning on having you back on relatively soon, but you really caught a lot of attention with the recent article that you posted on Seeking Alpha. It's your most recent article on the free site, although, of course, your subscribers get a lot more than that. The name of the article is The Inflation vs. Deflation Tug of War. And this article really went viral, pun intended, getting a ton of reads, really more than 50,000 at last count, huge number of comments and social shares. It seemed to really strike a chord with investors. And so I'd love to attack this topic and how you present the push and pull between inflation and deflation here and what the likely outcome for the U.S. economy and investors is from two different directions here. The theoretical direction, i.e. what is the case for continued deflation in the short run, and how do we at least theoretically end up in a situation with runaway inflation down the road? And then the practical perspective, also from an investing standpoint, so how should investors be constructing portfolios to properly anticipate the likely scenarios that you've laid out?
Sounds great.
Awesome. So before we get into that, though, you had somewhat of a COVID-19 story yourself, and it kind of sidelined you for a couple of weeks there, I know. And I'm just curious, for listeners that haven't really heard this described in much detail, what was that experience like?
Sure. So, you know, I can't be entirely sure that I had COVID-19, because at the time, this was around the peak of the outbreak in the New York area, so testing was less prevalent. But I was quarantined with a relative who did in fact have a positive test, and then I developed the common symptoms that you hear, pretty severe chills, upper respiratory congestion, just body aches and fatigue. You know, overall, my symptoms were relatively mild compared to what you hear. But the things that stood out to me was the chills were pretty extreme. You know, I walked around the house with like a winter hat the entire day. And there were a few sleepless nights because the upper respiratory congestion gets pretty intense, and it's tough to have the sensation that you clear the congestion. So had a couple sleepless nights there, but you know, it was relatively mild. It took, I would say, almost 2 weeks for me to feel back to 100%. So all of those things make me believe that I probably had it. The relative that I was quarantined with had a more extreme experience, including a loss of taste for almost 3 weeks, which was pretty crazy. But all in all, it was relatively mild. I feel fortunate in that regard. But it certainly does take you out for a little while. So something to take seriously.
Yeah, definitely. And I remember you were describing when you came back to your subscribers in the chat room there, that even though you weren't really actively sick anymore, you were still lethargic and feeling tired for a while afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, I've had some pretty serious flus, which were more severe for me, at least, but more acute in the sense that I had some flus, you know, years ago where I had, you know, very, very high fevers, but maybe the whole process was over in 5 days. For me, this was more mild than that, but it just didn't go away. That was the big thing. I mean, it really lasted every bit of 2 weeks, and my relative that had it was every bit of 3, even 4 weeks, perhaps. So that was the thing with this illness, is that it really just does not go away. So you know, a lot of times there were a couple of days where I felt like I was over the hump, had a good night's sleep, and then a day later had a lot of respiratory congestion and I felt like I got worse. So there were a lot of ups and downs within the 2 weeks, but it certainly lasts a really long time.
Yeah, that seems to be a common description there. That a couple of friends, I'm 40, my friends are the same age, so, you know, not really in that risk category either. And they were specifically surprised by both how long and drawn out the thing was, and the fact that they felt like they were getting better, and then suddenly they were knocked back on their ass again. And then,
yeah, I totally agree with that.
They felt like they were getting better, and just kind of back and forth like that. All right. Well, anyway, glad you're feeling better now.
Yeah, thank you.
Feeling energetic and in time for this massive bounce back rally that we've had. Maybe it's not a bounce back rally. Maybe it's just the start of a new prolonged bull market. We'll get into that during our conversation, I'm sure. So it seems like with the uncertainty that lies ahead for the global economy, and I don't think anybody really knows how long the current situation is going to drag on for, how long unemployment is going to stay super elevated. The stock market, to me at least, appears to be essentially priced for a best case scenario right now in terms of just a straight up V-shape recovery with no prolonged recessionary kind of characteristics. Bond markets, on the other hand, though, continue as we speak today on May 12th to make all-time record lows in the U.S., and are essentially pricing in little or no real growth for what seems like the next decade at this point. In your opinion, who is right here, stock or bond investors?
So I typically go with the bond market, but there's, you know, some interesting stuff going on with the stock market. And I think we talked about this a little bit in the last podcast.
Oh yeah, everybody should listen to that, by the way.
Great. You know, there's a separation going on in the sense that not all stocks have performed that well. You know, financials have underperformed the rally. One of the ETFs that we were short for quite some time, almost 2 years, was Regional Bank ETF KRE, which we closed that short at the end of March and then just put that short back on. It's down about 15, 16% from its peak already. So what I see going on is investors see the low interest rates and immediately assume that low interest rates justify higher multiples. But we, you know, can see from Japan and Europe that low interest rates are low for a reason. If there's no growth and no inflation in the economy, then interest rates are low. That typically feeds through to corporate profits. So if interest rates are zero, but a corporation has no growth, they don't really justify a higher multiple. On the other hand, what's unique about the US market relative to other countries is the technology stocks. So you can make a case that if you have technology stocks that are growing 20, 25% per year, those companies perhaps would justify a higher multiple from lower interest rates. So I like to look at a cyclical to defensive performance ratio, which I remove technology from because it's a little bit of an exception. And the cyclical stocks really haven't performed all that well. So I think that the stock market is being dragged higher a lot by the NASDAQ, or the big five technology stocks, which has made the rally look a little bit more extreme. But I think some of the underlying trends in the stock market, some of the more cyclical sectors, if you look at regional bank KRE, things like that, those are more in line with the bond market. And also, you know, the commodity market aligns with the bond market. At EPB Macro Research, we track non-exchange traded commodities. So, you know, there are commodities like oil and copper, which everyone likes to speculate on, and they have big liquid futures contracts, and that can drive the price around quite a bit. But the Commodity Research Bureau publishes some indexes with commodities that are less easy to speculate on, things like copper scrap instead of copper. And those indexes declined and we're declining at about a 15-16% annualized rate at their lows, since recovered a little bit. But I would say that the bond market, the currency market, the commodity market, and, you know, the underlying trends of the stock market are all pretty much aligned once you remove some of those big technology stocks. And, you know, it's tough to say that the rally in those is totally unjustified if you assume that those companies can continue generating double digit growth with zero interest rates.
Sure, and I have to assume just how safe their balance sheets are make them places that investors will want to flee, because even if you say, okay, the multiple on an Apple or a Amazon or a Google or a Microsoft doesn't, and I guess Facebook is the fifth of those, doesn't look particularly sexy from a historical perspective right now, you then look at their growth rate and you say, even if that comes down significantly because of a prolonged recession, you look at their balance sheets and the quality factor on those companies. And it feels like that may be one of the main reasons that the NASDAQ 100 has actually outperformed S&P 500 or the Dow.
You know, you're totally right about that. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, you could even make the case, which I've heard before, that these big technology stocks, which are conglomerates at this point, are basically like utilities in a sense. And utilities are the best performing sector historically when growth slows and interest rates fall. So, you know, with huge buyback programs, reasonably sized dividends, cash cows, they're almost like technology's version of utilities, which makes sense from that analysis.
Totally, yeah, especially the movement over to a services subscription model for companies like Apple and Microsoft. It really kind of drives that home. They just collect their $10 or $20 payment every month from people. Maybe they re-up them on a big purchase every 3 to 5 years, and you know, kind of just like minting cash every single quarter for them.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Nice. Okay, cool. So you lay out the current consensus in your piece, and this seems to really hold whether a market analyst is a long-term inflation bull or bear, that the current monetary and economic environment is highly deflationary, really a continuation in many ways of the three-decade secular trend in this regard. Can you just make that case a little more clearly for listeners why the current environment, there's really no disagreement, is deflationary?
Sure. So one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that every, you know, when they announced QE1, it was new, and market participants raised inflation expectations because everyone thought it was money printing. Same thing happened with QE2, QE3. And then once we got to the not QE, or what people called it in Q4 of 19, inflation expectations were not rising as significantly, and interest rates started to come down. Even January and February, before the pandemic really hit the United States, interest rates were coming down, and, you know, they were not totally bought into the inflationary thesis from the new QE. So what we have to look at is why has inflation been declining for the last 30 or 40 years? And the point that I make in the article is that the two biggest factors are declining rates of population growth and declining rates of productivity growth, which is most closely correlated to increased levels of debt. So if you continue to have slower rates of population growth and the level of debt rises, particularly unproductive debt, which would be defined as anything that doesn't produce an income stream. So if you take on debt to buy a t-shirt, let's say, then in the future, you have to divert money from a productive source to repay that shirt plus interest. That would be an unproductive use of debt. So as we look in this crisis, well, what's going on? Population growth is a long-term factor, which is not really going to change much because of this, but the level of debt has skyrocketed, which we continue to believe is inflationary. That's the common thing. We're taking on so much debt. The federal government's taking on so much debt. It must be inflationary. But we also have to consider that the corporate sector, the household sector, everybody's taking on an extreme amount of debt just to survive, just to get through the crisis. We, on the federal level, we passed bills to send stimulus payments, which was necessary. People need that. But if people take those stimulus checks and pay their rent, pay their food bills, then the government's taking on more debt to finance people's day-to-day living, sort of, you know, the trend of what we've been doing. So from a high level, the two largest structural forces, declining rates of population growth and increased levels of debt, have all been exacerbated by this crisis. So those, from a high level, will make the disinflationary trend worse. The difference this time is monetary policy. Although monetary policy is not all that different than what we've been doing. The government buys treasury and agency securities, and the monetary base increases, money supply increases. But as long as that money stays within the financial sector, it stays as deposits held at the Fed, then the velocity of money goes down. And we know that GDP is equal to money times velocity. So we continue to see these charts of M2 growth hitting an all-time high, circulating on Twitter and Seeking Alpha, you know, which scares people into thinking that money supply growth automatically translates to inflation. It's not really the case. For inflation to start, for an inflationary process to begin, you have to have an increase in money supply growth with at least stable velocity. But velocity has been basically collapsing, and this recession will be no different. So from a very high level, slowing population growth, increased levels of debt will reduce productivity, and the stimulus that's coming from the Federal Reserve is really just more of the same. It's buying treasury and agency securities, increasing the monetary base, increasing the money supply. But if that money stays in the financial sector, then the velocity of money will go down. So from a high level, that's what's going on.
Sure. Does the fact that, and I believe this program actually started today officially, that the Fed is now actually buying corporate debt as well in the form of corporate debt ETFs, does that weigh into the equation at all? Because it's not really staying on the Fed balance sheet at that point, or is it?
Sure. So a lot of these programs that the Fed has been doing with corporate bonds, you know, they are buying corporate bonds from the sense that they're going to be buying these ETFs. But if you were to buy something, typically you'd be responsible for the default. In this particular case, what's going on in a lot of these SPVs is the Treasury makes an equity investment into the special purpose vehicle, the SPV. Let's say they put $10 billion into the SPV. The Fed will lend to that SPV and buy $100 billion of corporate bonds. And some of them are going to default. So if 5% of them default, they would have lost $5 billion on that purchase. That $5 billion, that loss doesn't accrue to the Fed. That comes out of the Treasury. So, you know, in a scenario where they lost, let's say, $15 billion, the Fed would either hold back remittance of future interest payments to the Treasury, or the Treasury would have to put more equity into the SPV. So in all of these cases, the Treasury is really on the hook for the losses from these programs. So I don't think it changes the equation much, because if they accrue a lot of losses from these programs and the Treasury has to continue funding these programs, they have to do that by issuing more debt. So the debt kind of just continues to build up. And, you know, one of the really critical points to hammer home is, you know, we continue to think of these new novel ways to solve a debt problem. At the end of the day, we have a problem in the economy of way too much debt, not just on the federal side, corporate, household, state and local. The problem is too much debt. And every time a crisis comes around, someone comes around with a new theory as to how they can increase debt and solve the previous debt problem. When the reality is, you just can't solve a debt problem by taking on more debt. You can only solve a debt problem two ways. One is through inflation, or two is through austerity, meaning you have to clear the debt. Those are really only two paths. And we continue to go down a road of increasing debt on top of debt on top of debt. And the result is slower growth, lower inflation. And that's, you know, they're more fancy policies. They're more, I guess they stretch the Federal Reserve Act a little bit, you could say. But at the end of the day, they're just policies of increasing debt to prevent defaults on old debt.
Sure. Yeah. And this all sounds very deflationary to me when it comes down to it. And then I guess if you look at other national examples here, so you look at countries like Japan, you look at countries like Germany, who really have had the same lack of population growth and productivity growth that we've had in the U.S. They were just a generation or two ahead. Is that the basic thesis here, that the U.S. is really just a generation behind Japan and Western Europe when it comes to all of this?
Yeah, from a high level, I think that's right. You know, just to circle back for a second, you know, this crisis was obviously impossible to foresee, but a well-run corporation would theoretically have a rainy day fund for any unforeseen event. So
sure, like the five companies we discussed earlier that I don't think between them have laid off a single person as a result.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. So if a corporation faces an unforeseen event and they should go bankrupt, or they should default, or they should restructure. But what we do is we increase debt at the federal level in order to keep them afloat so that their existing bondholders don't lose any money. All we're doing is making an indebted company even more indebted. So, you know, the people call them zombie companies. And that's really what's gone on in Japan and Europe, in the sense that we really don't allow defaults. So what we do is we just tack on more debt and more debt and more debt, and it makes these companies less and less profitable. Sure, interest rates have come down, but if you continue to tack on more debt, then these companies have to pay out more interest, and it hurts their profitability, and it also makes them extremely vulnerable to any rise in interest rates. So just to deviate for 1 second, what happens in an economy that's over-levered is everyone says, it's not a problem because interest rates are so low right now. Debt service cost is low, so the economy can improve. Well, if the economy starts to improve, then treasury rates rise because growth and inflation starts to increase. Well, now interest rates aren't low anymore. Once the treasury rates rise, that brings the level of interest in the entire economy up. It brings mortgage rates higher, corporate rates higher, state and local rates higher. And now all of that debt has to roll into higher interest, and that immediately slows growth. And that's exactly what we've seen this entire economic cycle. We've seen, you know, three or four cyclical bounces in growth, which immediately get crushed by increased interest expense. The best example is 2016. The economy went into a slump. China stimulated like crazy. The economy started to recover. The global economy started to reflate. The Federal Reserve confused a cyclical rebound with a structural shift. They tried to raise interest rates. And even before the pandemic happened, the global economy was already basically in a quasi-recession. So it's not the level of interest rates today that's a problem. It's the fact that debt levels are so high that interest rates can never rise without it immediately crimping growth and bringing growth right back down, or a recession. When you look at Japan, this happens every couple of years. In the US, we're in a little bit better situation than Japan. So we've been oscillating between periods of rising growth and slowing growth. We've, you know, hit the cusp of a recession in 2016, avoided it. We hit the cusp of a recession in 2019 and looked like we were going to avoid it before this pandemic happened. But in Japan, they follow the same trend, but since their growth is pressed towards zero, every time they have that cyclical decline, it's a recession. And that's the path that we're going to be heading on. Around the world, you're just going to see more frequent recessions because trend growth is going to be pressed towards zero. And every time you have a little bit of a pickup in the economy, interest rates will rise, interest expense will go up, and it'll immediately crimp growth. So that's the high level of what's going on, and I just wanted to make that clear. But yeah, you're exactly right. So Japan and Europe are in similar situations. Their population growth is even worse, but they're also more indebted once you take into account public and private debt. But that's the general theme of what's going on in Japan and what's going on in Europe. And I believe that Europe has a big problem now as well. Their banking system is a lot more fragile than the U.S. banking system, which we took some steps to clear some of that up after 2008. But I would agree from a high level, from a debt perspective, the U.S. economy is, perhaps two cycles behind Japan, maybe one cycle behind Europe.
Sure. And I mean, essentially, the governments around the world, the central banks around the world, have to keep rates at zero or very close to it at this point with all of the balance sheet expansion that's happened, because they simply will not be able to meet any even small rises in their debt servicing payments at this stage forward until they unwind their balance sheet significantly, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you can see the bond market is pricing that in. So we've, on Bloomberg, they have a function called market implied policy rate, which, takes like the Fed funds futures curve out 3 years, and it looks at what the market is suggesting that the Fed funds rate is going to be, 3 months from now, 6 months from now, a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now. And they do this for basically every country. And the Fed funds futures curve is saying that there's zero chance that the Fed raises rates in the next 3 years. There was that period last week where, it dipped. The futures curve suggested negative rates. It's since reversed. But the bond market out 3 years is saying no chance of any increases. And if you look out 5 years, the five-year rate's trading at 30 basis points, basically saying that over the next 5 years, there's really no chance that the Fed is going to raise rates. So what's happening is the whole curve is starting to press towards zero. I mean, there's still some steepness towards the 30-year rate. But as the bond market gets more and more convinced that the Fed is never going to get off zero, then the whole curve is going to start to press towards the Fed funds rate, because there would be no difference essentially, other than some inflation premium. But as the inflation rate starts to press down and potentially go towards deflation, then that exacerbates the move towards zero. And we can see the curve, getting very, very flat out to, 2 years, it's, under 20 basis points, 5 years, 30 basis points, 7 years, I think it's under 50 basis points. So and when you look at this implied policy rate for Europe and Sweden and Switzerland and Denmark, over the next 3 years, the market's saying they're not going to get out of negative rates for the next 3 years. So the bond markets have really picked up on the fact that the central banks are probably not going to be able to raise interest rates for the foreseeable future. When you think about 2008, they lowered interest rates to zero. It took, 6 or 7 years for them to even consider raising rates. And then they raised rates 25 basis points, and then they had to wait a whole nother year before they started to raise them again.
Yeah.
And, if you consider that this crisis is perhaps worse than 2008, our level of debt going into the crisis is far worse than it was during 2007. Your starting hypothesis could be it could take at least 5 years to get out of it. And I think the bond market is sufficiently priced that in.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I guess at least, obviously, this was terrible for people that lost their jobs, but large and small businesses were allowed to go under in 2008, in 2009, or they were essentially wiped out and they kept the name alive, cases like Merrill Lynch, let's say, but they really were a Chapter 11 style case. This time around, if nobody is allowed to go under, how does that make the situation even worse to some extent?
Well, it just makes the situation worse because the company is just going to come out with so much more debt. They're not going to be able to finance new projects. They're probably not going to be able to hire staff. And they're just going to be, ultimately, they're just going to be more susceptible to any slowdown in the economy. And that's what it really comes down to. It just makes the economy incredibly fragile because any slowdown or any drop in revenue has a dramatic impact when companies are so levered. One of the things that we saw this economic cycle was that the volatility of the cycle compressed. So growth oscillated from 1% to 3%, but the volatility of the actual economic cycle the change in growth within this economic expansion was incredibly suppressed. And that you know allowed corporations to really lever up and not feel much of the impact. But as the economy moves to a more indebted stage and we start to flirt with more frequent recessions, it's just going to make the corporate sector, you know, the public companies, but also, like you said, small businesses, it's just going to make them really susceptible to slowdowns. And they're going to tighten their belts. They're going to be aware of that. They're probably going to hire less employees. Wages are probably going to be stagnant as a result. It's just going to make the system unable to make the investment needed to generate long-term growth. The only way we can generate long-term growth in the country or in any economy is you need productive physical investment that generates an income stream. Well, with interest rates at zero, if you want to generate an income stream, you need to take some level of risk. When a company is so levered and the economy, the prospects are so weak, people aren't going to take that risk. They're just going to hoard the cash. They're going to buy back stock. They're going to do things that don't entail that level of risk. And it's just going to really hinder the productivity of the economy. And it's just going to lower the trend rate of growth. You know, we've in the 90s, trend rate of growth was, you know, somewhere maybe in the 3% range. In the early 2000s, maybe high twos, low threes. This economic cycle, you know, we couldn't muster a year much above 2%, 2.1%. Whenever we get out of this current crisis, I would expect that trend to continue. I would expect trend growth in the economy to slow something towards 1%, something even lower than 1%, which means that any little downturn puts you below zero. And that's really the problem.
Sure. Yeah. And I guess case in point, we saw in the lead up to this that business investment was generally very low.
That's right. Core capital goods spending peaked, I believe it was in September of 2017, which we were talking about booming economy in late 2017. In Q1 of 18 is when the global economy started to peak and roll over and people started to notice that. U.S. economy didn't really start to show notable signs of slowing until Q3 of 18. But yeah, capital spending peaked September, I think it was September of 2017. To your point,
totally. And also just to reiterate along the lines of how you're describing the yield curve, both here in the U.S. and in Western Europe, and just the flatness of it, or the implied fact that it's going to be in a negative space in many Western European countries, kind of makes your short of KRE on the regional banks in the U.S. or of the European banking system a pretty obvious play, because it's just totally unclear how any of these publicly traded firms are supposed to make money in that sort of a prolonged flat curve, low rate environment.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I actually wrote about this weekend in a note to subscribers. You know, when I talk about shorting banks, I never touch the large money center bank, you know, JP Morgan. I never touch any of those.
Touching the broker dealers, essentially. You're not.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, regional banks is a more clean proxy to me. But as far as the economy is concerned, it's really, you know, it's shadow banks. It's any institution that borrows short and lends long. And in the U.S., we have a very large shadow banking system that does a lot of lending as well. As far as the yield curve, the last three recessions, if you look at the spread between the twos and the 30s, the 30-year rate, the last three recessions coming out of the recession, the curve steepened to almost 400 basis points. If you look at the twos tens, the curve steepened to almost 300 basis points, like clockwork. At the end of every recession, it peaked at 250 to 300 basis points. Today on the twos tens, we're supposed to be reopening the economy, coming out slowly, crawling out of this decline. The twos tens is 50 basis points, and we're about 100 basis points on twos thirties, and this is even with the Treasury trying to load supply on the long end of the curve. They're trying what they can to steepen the curve, but the growth and inflation prospects that the bond market's picking up are quite grim. So it's not allowing that curve to steepen. It's really difficult to have profitable financial institutions, large banks in XLF aside, the regional banks, the shadow banks. You look at what happened to the banks in Japan and Europe. There's just the banks just can't operate profitably with rates at zero and a flat curve. And it's difficult to generate a significant recovery in the economy with a very weak banking sector. We look back across many economic cycles. We haven't had a robust expansion with a weak banking sector before, and that's sort of what happened in Japan. It's what's happening in Europe. If you can't generate any profitability in the banks, they don't extend credit into the economy, or they tighten standards on consumers. It's difficult to really have a robust economy that extends to Main Street. What ends up happening is, there's no profitability in a curve. Consumers aren't credit worthy. Banks don't want to take on the risk to loan to them. They'd rather do financial transactions. The money piles up in the financial system, in the stock market, corporate bonds, stuff like that. The actual growth rate in the economy never improves. Wages stagnate. So yeah, the fact that the curve can't steepen meaningfully is an important thing that I'm watching. If we start to see the curve steepen, if 10-year rates can rise 100 basis points from here, that would be helpful for the economy, for the recovery. I would be surprised if we get 100 basis points lift on 10-year rates. But even if we do, it goes right back to what we were talking about earlier in the conversation. Mortgage rates go up, housing activity slows, and you start the whole process again.
Sure. And now a quick break so I can tell you about one of my favorite investing services, EPB Macro Research, run by Eric Basmajian. Eric is head of macro research at Perval Global, a discretionary hedge fund specializing in global macro-driven trades across all major asset classes. He first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2017, building up a following of more than 12,000 investors and becoming Seeking Alpha's top contributor in the economy vertical through his unparalleled analysis of key macroeconomic trends and his ability to turn this analysis into actionable top-down portfolio advice. In addition to the steady stream of macro analysis subscribers to EPB Macro Research receive, they also gain access to Eric's model tactical asset allocation and long-only asset allocation portfolios, an active chat room, and direct access to Eric for all your investing questions. And of course, relevant to listeners of Let's Talk ETFs, those model portfolios are all ETF portfolios. These portfolios have beaten the S&P 500 month after month, right through the recent coronavirus bear market. You can hear Eric's thoughts on the current market by listening to episode 35 of Let's Talk ETFs in an episode titled A Top-Down All-Weather ETF Portfolio, Coronavirus Edition. Subscribe to EPB Macro Research by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Eric Basmajian, that's Basmajian, into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for EPB Macro Research there. Start your 2-week free trial today. And we're back. So moving over to the inflation side of the debate here, what is the theoretical case, at least, for significant inflation at some point over the next, let's say, half a decade or so?
So as long as we continue doing the same thing, we're going to continue getting the same result. The big, big shift that I'm watching is as these central banks realize, and it's more to the central banks, it's the federal government as well, realize that there's absolutely no way out of zero interest rates or negative interest rates, and they cannot generate inflation. And you know, I know that bothers people. There's inflation in healthcare, and there's inflation in food, and I get that. But inflation, as the bond market is concerned about it, they just can't generate inflation. They can't generate a steep curve with the policy tools that they have. They can't lower interest rates anymore. They've done basically more QE and expansion of the monetary base than anyone thought was possible, and still inflation expectations don't rise. So the concern is that the central banks in coordination with the federal government would move to something more directly or more direct form of money printing. And that would be extremely inflationary. And the problem is once you start that, it's very difficult to stop. The difference here is that the Treasury issues debt and the primary dealers buy it. The Fed buys it from the primary dealers. And then they get a deposit at the Fed, an overnight deposit. And all that really happens there is they shorten the maturity of the debt held by the public sector because they take maybe a 7 or 10 year bond out of circulation and give the banks an overnight deposit. The liabilities of the Fed are not legal tender. You can't go and spend excess reserves. That has to go back into the economy through a different channel, through loans and things like that. If they changed the Federal Reserve Act, and this is true for a lot of different central banks, and this would require congressional approval, you can't just do it with the Treasury Secretary and the Fed, where the Federal Reserve, their liabilities can directly pay for the Treasury's bills, that would be inflationary. An example would be the Treasury issues a trillion bonds at auction, and the Fed prints the money and buys the bonds. So now you could basically spend what the Fed is, what the Treasury is issuing, without increasing debt. So what happened in England is the Bank of England just advanced. I think it was $400 billion to the federal government and said, here's $400 billion, you guys can go spend it. And if there's no increase in debt in that process, then that's direct money printing. What's going on here in the US is dollar for dollar, what we spend, we increase debt. The Treasury issues the debt and we spend it. If we move to a situation where the Treasury can start spending money or the Fed directly can start spending money without increasing debt, that is the definition of money printing. That's not what we're doing right now, but that is what I would be on the lookout for. One thing that Jay Powell continues to reiterate, I think the last two or three times he spoke, he said, the Federal Reserve has lending powers, not spending powers. And that's the critical point. The Fed can't spend. They can't buy things directly. All they can do is lend in various capacities. So once we move to a situation where the Federal Reserve starts spending money directly and we start dropping money into the economy without a commensurate increase in debt, that's very inflationary.
Sure. Is that actually what's happened in England with what the Bank of England has done? And I know you've written about this, or are they claiming that there's some difference there?
Well, they're claiming that, so what they've used this in the past, they've used this facility in the past, but they've used it on small scale. And what they say is that the federal government has an overdraft account at the central bank, and they promise that that they will pay it back and that it's not the primary means for what they're doing and for their spending. And they're saying that, the disruption in markets from the pandemic has made the bond market not liquid, and it's difficult for the federal government to issue gilts, I guess. And so temporarily, we're going to take the money from the central bank, and once the bond market clears up, we'll start to issue bonds and repay the central bank. And they've done it on a very, very small scale. I don't even think they've started to use that facility heavily. I'll have to check on that. But when you look at the pound, you know, the pound didn't collapse. The gilt yields, the last time I checked, you know, I haven't checked in a few days, but last I checked were 0.3%. So the market didn't take it as extraordinary inflationary either. My concern is that once you start to step over the line and the federal government, you know, says we'll pay it back, and they don't, that becomes a problem.
Becomes akin to direct printing at that point.
It's because it's an arm's length transaction with the central bank. It's not a bond that, you know, the Treasury can't pay interest on some bonds and not other bonds. But if they have a direct account with the central bank, maybe they don't have to pay that.
Sure. And just before we get over to kind of practical steps that you're taking here, just as a point of comparison between developed economies with very strong central banking systems like the Fed, the Bank of England, ECB, Bank of Japan, etc. What would the likely outcome be when, let's say, an emerging economy, say like a Mexico or an Indonesia, attempts the same playbook as the Fed or Bank of Japan has taken? Are you concerned about ripple effects through the global financial system were such a thing to occur, where their currencies actually get devalued to the point that they start defaulting on their bond payments across the global financial system?
So that's a good question. So when we look across the world, we look at these situations of too much debt. And McKinsey did a study on this. And what they ended up concluding was that all of the major economies, US, Europe, Japan, they can't devalue their way out of debt because it would spur retaliation. If Europe devalued their currency, let's say, and they got a lot of exports because of that, and it helped their economy, well, then Japan would probably retaliate because it would be directly stealing growth from them, the US as well. If you're a small economy, and you know the threshold I'm not certain about, but the major economies are certain. If you're a small economy, let's say maybe, you know, like Myanmar or Vietnam, they've devalued their currency a lot.
I was gonna mention Vietnam.
And they devalue, is the US really going to respond? Probably not. So small emerging market currencies have solved the debt problem by hyperinflation. The currency devalues, whether intentionally or not, the debt sort of just gets wiped away. And then they have to start clean, usually with a currency pegged back to the dollar. And if you're small enough, you know, you don't steal enough growth from the big guys, nobody retaliates. So I think that situation's a little unclear. Mexico may be a big economy, or maybe too big for them to substantially devalue in a way that steals growth from other trading partners. But yeah, I think that would be the critical point, is that smaller economies can do it. Larger economies typically results in some sort of retaliation or currency wars, as the term goes these days.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so I'd love to turn from the theoretical to the practical here. You run model portfolios for your subscribers at EPB Macro Research. You run a long-only portfolio and a long-short portfolio also. You're short of KRE, which is back on in May now that banks have bounced back to some extent. Without giving away too much of your secret sauce here, how are you positioning portfolios right now, and how has that changed in recent months as a response to the Fed's and other central bank actions, and I guess more broadly speaking, as a result of the massive global economic shock that's been brought on by COVID-19 and by the forced shutting down of global economies?
Sure. So I'll just start from a high level again. I think we touched on this briefly in the last podcast. When I construct a portfolio, you always have to start with a baseline portfolio or whatever your baseline portfolio is. It could be different for everybody. Not everybody has the same goals, but let's say some people may have a baseline of a 60-40. Some people may have a baseline of 50% stocks, 50% bonds. Whatever it is, you have to know what your baseline is. Otherwise, it's difficult for you to assess what positions you're overweight and underweight if you don't have a reference point. So at EPB Macro Research, and what I do is I use an all-weather portfolio as a baseline. all-weather portfolio is a combination of stocks, short-term bonds, long-term bonds, commodities, and gold. And I take that baseline portfolio and I shift the portfolio away from the baseline in the direction of the assets that are likely to perform the best given the upcoming environment. So if I thought growth was really going to improve, if 30% was the baseline stock portfolio, may have 40%. Or if growth was going to slow materially, I may have more treasury bonds and I may have a 20% allocation to stocks. And I get this question from subscribers a lot. If you think growth is going to slow, why do you have any stock exposure at all? Well, if your baseline is 30 and you have, let's say, 15, in effect, you're short 15% from your baseline. So from a high level, I start with an all-weather portfolio and I shift the exposure in the direction of the assets that are likely to perform the best, or at least have the best risk-adjusted returns. So from that starting point, given the outlook that disinflation or deflation, I believe, is the more immediate risk rather than inflation, treasury bonds are an overweight. I call it an overweight allocation of risk. Stock exposure is a little bit underweight, given the fact that we're basically still at pretty extraordinary levels of valuation based on long-term measures.
Yeah, we had about a week there where valuations started to look normal. But
exactly.
the snapback was just so crazy that it really wasn't even there for long enough for anybody to...
That's, I think Buffett touched on that in his webcast. So heading into the pandemic, we were forecasting slower growth and slower inflation. So we had an overweight allocation of bonds, we were underweight stocks, we were overweight gold, we were overweight cash. So in March, when the market fell apart, the S&P ended up falling about 12.5% at the end of that month. Our portfolio was up 3 basis points. So we dodged that entire decline and preserved all the gains. We shifted the portfolio a little bit less underweight stocks. So our underweight went from, you know, pretty underweight stocks to not so underweight. And the weighted beta of the portfolio shifted a little bit higher to account for the decline in valuations in the market. And then in April, we gained about another 1%. But then, you know, the market was up about 12 and valuations got pretty extreme again. So then all we did was we took the underweight exposure of stocks back up. So we were more underweight stocks, increased the overweight allocation to treasury bonds, and re-added the KRE short. You know, KRE, we started shorting in May of 2018, didn't cover it until March of 2020, down about 50%. In about 1 month, it rallied.
So you were up about 50%, correct?
That's right.
I was going to say, you must have killed it on that trade.
And it was in various sizes throughout, but it was a constant short the entire time. And, you know, I think KRE bottomed maybe around $20, $29, something like that. It rallied all the way back to 40, put the short back on because the environment's the same. The outlook for the financial institutions is the same, put the short back on. And I think month to date, KRE is maybe down another 10%, maybe it's $34 as of today. So, you know, maybe 15% from that peak. So to answer your question, most simply, we start with the all weather portfolio as a baseline. We shift the allocation towards the assets that are going to perform the best, or what we think is going to perform the best. Right now, we're overweight treasury bonds, we're overweight gold, we're overweight cash for some optionality, underweight commodities because of the deflation. So we were able to avoid a lot of the decline in oil and stuff like that, at least relative to the baseline portfolio. And that's the way we move forward. And, you know, I don't shift every month. I mean, when the market shifts, you know, 15 to 20% per month, then there are shifts to be made. But I try and take a longer outlook, try and take a 12 month outlook at least, and position accordingly. So, you know, if my allocation is overweight treasury bonds and treasury bonds are down this month and stocks are up, you know, it's no panic. It's more of a longer term outlook. And we try and, you know, maximize the return per unit of risk. You know, making 10% returns is great, but if you have a 50% drawdown and you got like 30% volatility, that doesn't work for some people.
It doesn't work for almost anyone, I think. I mean, people think, yeah, it's fine, I can just ride that out. But what inevitably ends up happening, and it's just been shown time after time through all kinds of different academic papers about behavioral finance, people end up holding out, and then the market, their portfolio keeps on going further down, and they panic and sell at the worst possible time, and then end up missing the snapback rally also. So yeah, if you can get 80% of the returns with a tiny fraction of the volatility, many, many, or even most investors will do way better in terms of accumulation over the long term.
I think that's exactly right. And that's exactly the philosophy that we use. Just to give you some statistics. So even through that crazy decline in March, the EPB portfolio, our maximum peak to trough decline, so the highest intra-month mark to the lowest point, was a 5.5% total decline.
Right, versus 37% for the S&P 500 from February 19th through March 23rd.
So. Exactly. And, you know, over the we've been running the portfolio for essentially 3 years, generated a little bit less than 8% annualized returns with about 5% volatility. That's compared to, as of March 9th, that was 9% for the S&P with 22% volatility. So, you know, some people may want that extra 100 basis points for 4x the volatility. To me, that doesn't sound like a great trade-off. So that's the philosophy of how I run the portfolio and how I position.
Yeah,
sure. This is what I do with my accounts as well.
Sure. In terms of, so the all-weather portfolio is, of course, allocated to the S&P 500. And just wondering, you know, we were discussing those big five tech mega caps, which obviously have large positions. They are the largest position sizes in the S&P 500. But would you ever consider maybe diversifying that into maybe a split between the S&P 500 and something like the NASDAQ 100 to get those extra overweights on the FANG stocks based on the fact that they seem to be the only companies that still are growing combined with just super safe balance sheets, or not any reason to actively deviate from the all-weather portfolio?
No, that's a really good question. And one of the things that I like to remind subscribers is that the portfolio is a guide. You know, I'm not investing anybody's money. It's meant to be used as a guide, and it can be tailored to fit everybody's individual circumstances. You can look at the overweight and underweights based on what I think is going to happen, and then you can use that relative to your baseline, because not all subscribers use an all weather baseline. You know, I'm not suggesting to everybody that this is the exact way to do it. This is just what I'm doing. You know, there are subscribers that replace SPY with QQQ, and that's fine. That's perfectly part of the process. There are subscribers that, you know, 5% volatility may be a little bit too boring for them, so they gross up all the positions and try and get maybe the 7 or 8% volatility and get the return a little higher. So a lot of the customization I leave up to every individual subscriber, because there's no way that I can account for everybody's personal situation. Maybe some of the tech stocks are too risky for some investors, but I think that's a perfectly reasonable approach, is to customize the stock allocation. Other people, they like to pick their own stocks. It's part of the game. It's part of what they enjoy. So, you know, if I have a 10% or a 15% weighting to SPY, they just fill that 15% with stocks of their choice. They don't even have to use QQQ. They can just put Apple right in there. And it still fits the criteria. It just helps people manage their portfolio to understand, where am I overweight, where am I underweight, and what am I overweight and underweight relative to? And I think that's the most important
thing. Yeah, sure. No, that makes sense. And I think it's, you know, it's good for listeners to understand that you're not making actual recommendations here. What you're doing is setting up a baseline that everybody then, based on their life circumstances, their amount of money that they can afford to put at risk, their tolerance for risk, and a bunch of other things, ends up being able to customize that for themselves and what they're most comfortable with.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So a lot of people in the SPY or whatever the stock allocation is, some people fill it with dividend stocks. And, you know, I run the portfolio with very, very low volatility, because it's easier for people to come to the service, see what's going on, and then gross up the exposure rather than run it with, you know, 10 or 15% volatility, and someone that maybe has a lower risk tolerance would have a hard time dialing it down. I think it's easier to gross it up versus to dial it down. So I think that you explained it perfectly.
Sure. Now, in terms of, okay, so you're short KRE again in the regional banks. Any consideration on your part of also shorting something like XLE or maybe the E&P companies? Of course, this wouldn't have made sense when the XLE was down like 60 or 70% during that bottom period at the end of March. But at this point, you look at something like the XLE, it's bounced from like 23 all the way back up to $38. And it just feels like, considering how cheap oil still is, considering how badly global demand has been hit and likely to stay hit, considering things like elevated rates of unemployment, which again are going to keep both businesses and individuals using less fossil fuels to manufacture things to get to their job every day. It seems like this bounce back up is really a very rosy kind of scenario, when I think many people expect bankruptcies to start piling up in that sector. So just curious in terms of your thinking there, whether you would consider adding a second short position in something like XLE or maybe a more kind of granular exploration and production ETF.
Yeah, I would agree with your analysis very much. The one trouble I have with XLE is I think it's almost 50% Exxon and Chevron, which just makes it so concentrated that it's basically a play on the two majors. And, you know, some of the...
Yeah, that's a good call, actually. I had not realized that. Yeah, I'm looking at 23% Chevron and another 22 Exxon. Yeah, that's pretty
key. It's pretty concentrated. And yeah, the components farther down the list, some of these energy companies are priced for bankruptcy. So I haven't spent too much time on this sector, but I wonder if the rise in Chevron and Exxon is maybe a consolidation type play, that they're going to kind of swoop in and buy a whole bunch of players out. But
yeah, maybe something like XOP would make more sense.
Yeah, exactly. And I would agree with your analysis there, that especially in a recessionary growth slowing environment, those typically do not perform very well. Just a couple criteria that I typically use when shorting something. You know, when you're under, like, at least the way that I look at the portfolio from the all weather standpoint, if you shorted tech stocks in 1999, you were right, but perhaps you didn't make that much money.
Yeah.
And if you were just underweight tech stocks, or you were just in cash, that can be short enough. So that's why I always look at everything relative to the baseline portfolio. So if my all-weather portfolio is, let's say, 10% SPY, and 20% of that SPY, I'm making it up, is in the financials. So 2% of my 2% of my portfolio would be financials on the baseline. And I short like 2% KRE, and I add 2%, let's say, XLU or XLP or QQQ. Mm-hmm. I have the same equity exposure, but I'm now just underweight the financial sector. So sometimes for me, underweight is short enough. I don't always try and short everything. And sometimes with these energy companies, they're starting to get priced towards bankruptcy. Some of these rallies can get pretty intense. And I don't really have too many tactical trading strategies. I'm more long-term oriented. So these bounces can get pretty intense. And, you know, if you're a tactical trader, that seems like probably a great sector to play from the short or long side, because the rallies are so extreme. For me, what I look for in a trade is, I look for, does it align with the secular thesis? First of all, the multi-year thesis. If I had to short something and hold it for 3 years, would I be comfortable doing that? There aren't too many sectors that I would want to short and hold for 3 years, but if I had to, regional banks would probably be one. Well, why is that? If we look at the precedent in Japan and in Europe, if we do stay in this zero interest rate environment for 3 years and the curve does compress towards zero, those regional banks are going to be in a tough spot. So that's one factor. Another factor is what's the long-term secular trend of the asset? What's been the performance? Like, I would never short SPY. It's been in a, you know, multi-decade bull trend. There's obviously a reason for that. But if you look at something like KRE, even before the pandemic happened, KRE hadn't increased in price since 2016. If you look at the price for the end of 2019 to 2016, I think it was basically the same price. So there's a reason why KRE was not able to rise over the last 3 years. And if you look at a relative ratio, KRE divided by SPY, it's been in a secular downtrend, most likely due to the secular downtrend in growth and inflation. So does the position line up with the secular thesis? Is there precedent for how it's going to perform going forward? If I had to short it for 3 years, would I be comfortable holding it? And KRE is the main sector that fits the criteria there. And I do hold these positions for quite some time, you know, 2018 to 2020. So energy is an interesting one. It's pretty volatile, especially when you get to the XOP. I briefly had a industrials short on for a similar reason, secular growth story. But, you know, like, some people want to short the NASDAQ because it's just it's so high flying, or it's such a bubble, or whatever. That's not the game that I play in, because it doesn't fit those criteria. And would I want to short the NASDAQ for the next 5 years? Probably not.
Yeah.
And that's the way that I avoid getting carried out on a trade. You know, there's a lot of glory in top ticking the NASDAQ in 2000, but it's very difficult. And, you know, when you short something, typically you have a negative carry, you have to, you pay margin, you have to pay the dividend. So right out of the gate, you're coming 3-5% annually against you. That's another consideration. You know, what's the carry on the position? You know, some people don't consider that a lot. Even with options, that it's kind of built into the option.
Yeah.
So instead of shorting the NASDAQ, if you knew you were going into a recession, you could have bought, you know, 2-year rates when they were at, you know, 4-5%. You could have carried positively 4% or 5% instead of negatively. And then when the recession happens, the Fed lowered rates. I just try and think of the safest way to express the view rather than trying to go for the home run. It sort of fits with the low volatility strategy.
Yeah, no, does make sense. I guess for somebody that did want to carry out your strategy of avoiding financials, again, the NASDAQ 100 does give that, because it's an ex-financials index.
That's exactly right.
So it seems kind of, I mean, in general, the NASDAQ 100 is one of these very strangely constructed indexes, kind of, you know, along the lines of the Dow, which is price weighted. The allocations seem very strange there, but the makeup of it, at least to me in the current moment, feels almost perfect, where you have almost 50% of the fund in those top five positions. We mentioned Facebook being the smallest of the five, still being almost 5% of the NASDAQ 100, getting all the way up to 10 and 11% with Apple and Microsoft being the biggest position right now. And then you throw no financials and very little energy on top of that. You know, feels like
the only companies that seem to have any growth these days.
Yeah. Yeah. And you end up with some consumer staples companies like Pepsi in there, oddly, also. So yeah. In terms of gold, and again, you know, all-weather portfolio, you generally have an allocation to gold. Are you currently, in terms of where you generally are, over or underweight gold? And how does gold play into the whole deflation versus inflation thesis for you? You do mention it in that piece where if every bank is, let's say, expanding their balance sheets and pushing rates to historical lows in lockstep, the currencies basically all stay the same, but what does rise there is gold. So just curious for you to tie that into the whole conversation here.
Sure. So I'll make 2 points on that. First, as it pertains to gold, yes, the in an all-weather setup, there's always an allocation to gold. I've had an overweight allocation of risk to gold for quite some time. And the reason for that is falling real interest rates. So when you look at, let's say, like a 10-year treasury rate, you have 10-year break-even rates, the inflation expectation, and the difference between that is the real rate. As the real rate comes down, the price of gold generally rises. There's a lot of factors that contribute to it, but the most influential factor, in my view, is the real interest rate. And the reason for that is because, you know, gold is money. And buying gold and holding it, it earns no yield. So it's an opportunity cost. Your opportunity cost of buying and holding gold for 10 years is what you could have made by on the real rate. So the real rate is your opportunity cost of holding gold. As that real rate comes down, the price of gold rises. And you know, a lot of people make this mistake. It's not positive or negative real rates. It's the direction of real rates. So if real 10-year rates are -1%, and then they rise to -0.5%, that would be bad for gold, even though real rates are still negative, because it's all the rate of change that matters. So as real rates in the economy decline, which is a result of slowing expectations of growth, perhaps central banks, to the extent that they can boost inflation expectations, all of that contributes to declining real interest rates. That's a long-term secular trend. That fits the thesis. If it's a long-term secular trend, what's the reason for it? Growth slowing. I want to be long of that secular trend. So the expectation is that real rates would continue to decline. Now, the problem you could run into with gold is deflationary shocks. So gold can rise in deflation as long as real rates continue to go down. You could have -1% inflation expectations, but if short-term rates are -2, let's say, you still have a negative real rate, or the real rate can still decline. So it's not exactly inflation deflation. To me, it's real interest rates. As they come down, gold prices generally rise. So I'm long of gold in that sense, and I'm overweight gold because I believe the real rate's going to continue to come down over time. It'll be volatile, but it's going to continue to come down. The second point is that whenever I talk about overweight and underweight, I talk about the overweight allocation of risk. And what I mean by that is, let's say you have a portfolio of 5 assets, and they're 20% each for 100%. You would think that you'd be overweight gold, you'd have to have like a 25% allocation. But let's say you want it to be overweight cash as well. Just to use an easy example, let's say you had 50% cash in your portfolio. Well, then to equate the risk of everything else, everything would be a 10% position. So if you had 12% gold with 50% cash, as a percentage of your risk, you'd still be overweight gold in terms of the allocation of risk. So at one point, we had a really high cash position, and I think the gold position was down to like 3 or 4%. But relative to the all-weather baseline, that was still an overweight allocation of risk to gold. They had a new member join and ask a very reasonable question. You know, how could you be overweight gold with just 3 or 4%? Well, if the cash position is 90%, let's say, and you're still running an all-weather baseline, that 10% still has all 5 assets. So 3% would be overweight allocation of risk to gold. So to answer your question, gold fits in to falling real interest rates. It's a trend that I believe is going to continue with volatility, but it'll continue. So as real interest rates decline, gold prices are generally going to rise.
Sure. And then I guess the flip side of that, you are underweight other demand-based commodities right now, are you not?
That's exactly right. So underweight, you know, there's used a few different commodity ETFs. Commodity ETFs are a little bit tricky. A lot of them have K-1s. A lot of them have futures roll and stuff like that.
I was going to say, yeah, you can frequently be fighting a real uphill battle with
Contango there. Yeah, I've bounced around to a few commodity ETFs. But yeah, underweight ETFs that are overweight things like copper, oil, demand-based commodities and just overweight the pure gold ETFs.
Sure. And then just out of curiosity, it seems like even if, let's say, gold gets to a certain level and it's, you know, been basically at or above 1700 for the last few weeks now, we've seen the miners really take off, fund like GDX as a result of that, because even if gold now trades sideways for a while above a certain level, those businesses become very profitable, kind of in the same way that even if oil, let's say, stops falling and just sits at $30 a barrel, there are many, many oil companies that will simply go bankrupt at that price. It doesn't matter if oil doesn't fall any lower. So just out of curiosity, I know you don't generally play more sector or niche type funds here, but you do it on the short side occasionally. So any thought of diversifying that gold risk, maybe taking on some gold equity positions as well, or not at this stage?
It's a great point. I do like the play. I haven't added it to the portfolio. It's not an area I focus on very much. I think adding an allocation of miners does make a lot of sense. The reason I've avoided it is just because the leverage embedded in these companies, they are equity companies at the end of the day. And if there's a massive deflationary shock, I'd be better off in the in actual gold than the miners. But to your point, if gold continues to rise, then GDX will probably do better than GLD. It's a more levered play.
I mean, it is. You see the chart. You know, it started out maybe like a 12-month peak as markets peaked also. And it then literally dropped like 50%, but then just flew
right,
back up and is, you know, up over 100% over the last month
and
a half or so.
And, you know, a lot of that decline, I mean, there were some really crazy things. I mean, some of these ETFs were trading at crazy discounts to NAV. And, you know, I think some of it, I mean, then we saw the ratio of like GLD to GDX just like collapse. There was, yeah, and then I think some of these triple levered funds were like unwinding. There was a lot of crazy stuff that was going on. But yeah, I agree. I don't disagree with that play at all. I haven't added it to the portfolio. I know that there are some analysts that have good picks in the gold miner space, that they've done a lot of work on specific gold miners. The only one that comes to my mind is Franco Nevada. I don't have an opinion on it either way, but things like that. I haven't done the analysis on the individual companies. If I were to do it, I would do something like GDX, just my ETF focus, but I don't disagree with that at all.
Sure. And then I guess before we go here, and this has been really awesome as usual, Eric, thanks for being so generous with your time. Bringing it all back together, how do you make sense of the market action of the last, let's say, month and change? So as terrible as the carnage was in February and March, it kind of made sense, at least when people looked out 6 months and discounted all of those earnings that were just going to evaporate into thin air. Because maybe, for again, you go to the large tech companies, and maybe somebody was going to buy a new Xbox, or they're going to buy a new iPhone, big ticket purchase like that. So they defer it by 6 months, but it's not like Apple or Microsoft loses that revenue. But if you look at what's happened with the lockdown, the vast majority of earnings in the S&P 500 over whatever length of time the lockdown lasts for have simply evaporated into thin air. Hotels are not going to make up that money, and you know, cruises and hospitality companies, and neither will most of the companies there. That's business that has just disappeared. So how do you make sense of the action over the last, let's say, month and change since the March 23rd bottom? And then how do you manage to keep an even keel through all of it? Because I'm always impressed by the fact that you don't seem to have any extreme reactions to any of the things that are happening in the market. And the way you run your portfolios really matches that temperament that you bring to the table. So just if we could conclude with that.
Yeah, thanks. I think in the beginning, you outlined it perfectly. The market has an optimistic assumption of what's going to happen. And it's a little bit more nuanced than that, but that's the general theme. So the way that I think about it is it's obvious that we're in a deep recession right now. But because of how deep the recession is, and you know, once you're down like 80 or 90% year over year on some metrics, when the economy reopens, any increase will look like a large directional change, and the recession will be technically over if the economy reopens and consumption starts to improve. So there's a reasonable chance that by July, August, the recession is technically over.
Sure, although just to interject here for a second, under normal circumstances, I would agree. Unfortunately, the issue here is that it's impossible to even know if there's going to be a flare-up in cases and everything shuts down again, and there isn't even that that pickup. So that's where the exuberance...
That's exactly where I was going. So in my opinion, the market's pricing in that the recession will be technically over by the summer. The recovery will be slow, as evident by bond yields, but that we're just going to be on a general path of recovery from here on out. And maybe in 1 to 2 years, something by 2021, 2022, we're generally back to where we were. And if that does happen, then I think the market is correct in rallying, because this has been a crazy shock. In 2 years, we'll be back to normal. And it's probably reasonable for equity investors to just give everybody a pass on lost revenue in 2020 and maybe half of 2021. If that happens, I think that the action makes sense. But like you said, there's a lot of unknowns. And I don't necessarily even agree with that forecast, even if there are no flare-ups. I think that it can take a lot longer for business activity to return to 2019 levels. But if there's a flare-up and we have to do another lockdown, or airline travel is disrupted again, or major bankruptcies start to happen, all of those things, in my opinion, are not priced into the forecast. And if that does happen, then I think that we would see that the equity market take another decline.
I think we're going to test those lows we saw in late March very quickly if we start seeing bankruptcies pile up or the economic activity simply doesn't return in the next few months.
Exactly. I think that's probably right. I think it all comes down to the way that this develops. I mean, if we've solved the majority of the issues and we continue with social distancing and the economy is able to start to recover by the summer and it's slow but steady, and the liquidity injections and the Federal Reserve and the Congress have done enough where we can prevent any major disruptions, then I think the equity market's probably reasonable in its assumptions. I think it's up for every individual investor to determine whether that's a probable path or not. Virus aside, I just tend to fall towards the camp that thinks that this recovery will take a lot longer than 1 to 2 years. I don't think even if the virus was contained today, if a vaccine came out tomorrow, I mean, of course, equity markets rally, bonds would sell off, et cetera. But over the next 6 to 8 months, I don't believe that economic activity would return to its 2019 peak that fast. But I believe that that's what's priced into the market. And if that situation does occur, it's not a zero probability. There's some probability that things will improve from here and not look back. And if that's the case, then I guess that the equity market rally makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. So again, caveat.
That's at least how I square.
Yeah. No, it makes total sense the way that you describe it all here. And I.
Yeah. No, I just don't disagree with anything that you said. I mean, if we have a, you know, there are some virologists that think we've reopened, and I have no opinion on this anyway. I have no expertise in this area. But if we happen to have opened too early, let's say, and there's a flare up in cases, perhaps not in New York City, perhaps there's a flare up in cases in another major city, and we start to go down this path where we lock down, open, re-lock down, I think the market would take a different tune. But that's at this point just as speculative, I guess, as the other option. So I don't want to make a bet on the path of the virus per se. I'm rather just going to take my you know, I keep my exposure to equities as I always do, given the baseline portfolio. My underweight allocation to equities is more a reflection of the valuations that we're at, as opposed to my forecast of the virus. Just with a lot of economic risks on the horizon, you're not leaving yourself a tremendous margin of safety with valuations at high levels. You know, perhaps I would take a healthier slug of equity exposure if, you know, we were trading at maybe even average valuations, which were quite above average based on the way I look at it.
Yeah, yeah, no, definitely. I was going to say you had increased there at the beginning of April, correct? After that massive sell-off, because suddenly the valuations on equities, you know, were implying better long-term returns. But at this stage, I guess you've been forced to go underweight again.
Exactly. And you know, when you try and target month to month returns or quarter to quarter returns, and you know, you're underweight and the equity market goes up, it can be tough. But you know, we've been running the portfolio for about 3 years, have been pretty much underweight equities almost the entire time, and have generated, you know, like I said, annualized return that's maybe about 100 basis points under the S&P with a quarter of the volatility. So, you know, there are a lot of ways to go about it. A lot of people are very S&P 500 centric. But there are a lot of other ways that you can make a lot of money, and a lot of the performance that we've had is just avoiding the large declines rather than being fully invested during every up month.
Sure, I guess if you remove the last month and change, I assume you've actually outperformed the S&P, because the S&P has essentially been flat over the last.
Yeah, if you take away the last like 2 or 3 weeks, I mean, I publish a pretty transparent track record against like a 60-40 portfolio, S&P 500, Barclays aggregate. And if you take away the last 3 months over the last, if you take away the last like 3 weeks over the past 3 years, have outperformed everything, even on a nominal basis, not even accounting for like a risk adjusted return. But you know, it's a long game. So just going to keep going with the process.
Yeah, sure, definitely. And my point of view is that as amazing as equity markets have looked for the last 6 weeks, I like your chances of outperforming even nominally over the coming period, because I just can't see how the risk reward continues to favor an overweight to equities at this point.
Well, you've been on a hot streak. I mean, last time we talked was we had the podcast in February, I think, and then yeah. We were talking through like Google Chat right up until the virus happened. And I know you were long bonds, and I think you actually got out of a huge position, like. It might have been right near the peak. I mean, when things really went crazy, I remember we were talking. And you're like, "That's good for me. I'm out of here." And it turned out to be a great play.
The truth of the matter is, though, that a couple weeks after markets started to go down, I'd say about midway through that February March sell off, I generally, just because of the long-term horizon that I have, so I'm not planning on retiring for 25 or 30 years, I generally try to keep about an 80% allocation to equities. I knocked that down to 50%. When things got low, I moved it back up a bit, but I'm still totally underweight equities relative to where I'm normally at. And again, even with the long-term horizon, I want to keep some powder dry, because I do believe markets are going lower, and I think that's where real wealth accumulation happens. If you can shift that money over after there's been a 20 or 30% sell-off, that really, in the long run, looks great.
I totally agree. And you know your baseline, which I think is the most important thing. I mean, that's the whole point I'm trying to make here, is that, you know, 50% stock exposure to you could be incredibly underweight.
It is. Yeah, what it was. Someone who's, yeah.
If someone's, you know, 75 years old, 50% stocks could be crazy overweight.
Yeah.
You know? So it's all relative. And that's the way I try and express the portfolio. I try and express it as overweight, underweight allocations of risk relative to my baseline. And that way, if everyone knows their own baseline, they can adjust it that way. You know, there's no way that you can construct a one size fits all portfolio for everybody. You know, if you were popping around the service, underweight to you, like you said, could be 60, and it sounds like you executed that perfectly. So I think you got a good strategy.
Yeah, thanks. As perfectly as one could hope. I mean, it's, you know, it's always easy to beat yourself up and say, "Oh, I saw this coming. Why didn't I make the shift 2 weeks ago?" But, you know, it's impossible to time these things perfectly.
Well, you did a good job so far.
Thanks. Yeah. And I try, you know, I really like, I have friends that just, they kind of go all one way or the other. And I, you know, I always try to explain to people that if I'm less bullish on equities. I'm never going to go below 50 or 60% allocation to equities at my least bullish on them, because I just don't believe in market timing. I believe in those bands of risk and exposure, and I want to shift them around a little bit when things seem really just too good to be true or too bad to be true in a specific asset class. I really haven't touched my allocation in a very, very long time. I didn't buy into all the chatter in 2016 or 2018 about how things were really going to go belly up, but the whole COVID global shutdown seemed like a special circumstance.
Yeah.
So when the bottom started falling out of the market, I said, you know what, I've been thinking about it. It's time to actually do something here. And despite the fact that the rally keeps on going higher and higher, I have not been tempted to get back up to my old equity allocations. I don't see it in the valuations right now.
Totally agree. Underweight is short enough.
Exactly. Yeah. Still plenty long.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah, totally. Anyway, Eric, this has been great as always. Your way of describing the underlying structural economic issues, I think, is really just refreshing and really down to earth for people that are maybe less well-versed in this topic. And then the practical takes you have in terms of the portfolio construction also are really, I think, beneficial and I think should interest anyone that's interested in top-down portfolio construction.
No, I love coming on. I love your questions, and I'm always happy to do it anytime.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So we will do it again soon, I'm sure. Just before we get out of here, what's the best place for listeners that want to further research everything we've been discussing here online? Obviously, they should follow you on Seeking Alpha. Obviously, there's really no downside to taking the free trial in EPB macro research and just seeing if it's right for you or not, or even just, you know, signing up for a month or two and seeing how it shakes out. Where else online can people find you? I know you're on social media. What do you recommend?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And I think the best place outside of Seeking Alpha is on Twitter. You can find me at EPB Research.
It's easy enough. I do follow you there. You post a ton of charts. You're pretty active there. A lot of really great stuff.
Yep. That's usually where I hang out.
Nice. All right. Anyway, Eric, I'm going to let you go. We're in the middle of a market day here, so I'm sure you've got other things to do, but I do hope we can do this again soon.
Yeah, please. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. For disclosures, Eric Basmajian is long SPY, GLD, PDBC, TLT, IEI, SHV, VXUS, and is short KRE. I am long QQQ, VOO, BAR, SHY, and GBIL. If you've been enjoying Let's Talk ETFs, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you find this podcast useful, please consider leaving a review on one of those platforms so that other investors can discover it. You can also find this podcast on SeekingAlpha.com by typing Let's Talk ETFs into the search bar at the top of the site.